This is Community Voices on 91.9 UIS. I'm co-host Randy Eccles. Today, some neighbors that we are going to revisit with are ones that are celebrating 25 years of service here in Illinois. It's the Illinois Innocence Project. Welcome, Stephanie Campbell and Larry Golden. Thanks for joining us on Community Voices.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
25 years. We just celebrated 50 at NPR Illinois. 25 years is a big accomplishment. Some people would think, well, are there that many people who need to be exonerated? Let's start with the need.
The need is very great. Illinois is known in our country to be the wrongful conviction capital. We have the most exonerations, the most wrongful convictions in this state. When this was started 25 years ago, this was not even a known issue to most people. Even in the criminal legal system, it has really come to light probably since the 90s when DNA was starting to be used to convict people. They were starting to realize, oh, in cases that it looked like there was a possible wrongful conviction, it could be used to actually exonerate someone.
Before we get into the history of it, it's alarming that there are so many people wrongfully convicted. Before the 90s, like you were saying, people figured if the court convicted you, you probably deserved it.
Yes, that's so true. And what we've realized over the last 30 years, as this has become more of an area of law that is practiced, the five main contributors to wrongful convictions, things like false confessions that a lot of us erroneously would sit there and think, oh, I would never falsely confess. When you start looking at the social science studies, people tend to break down their defenses within an hour and a half. And when you have 15, 16-hour interrogations or interrogations that happen over days and people are sleep deprived and they're tired, studies are showing they'll say anything just to get out of that room, assuming further investigation will happen and it will show that they didn't commit this crime. They will falsely confess. Juveniles are even more likely to falsely confess than adults. Eyewitness misidentification, huge problem. Incentivized witnesses who are testifying against somebody and having charges dropped against them and they're going free. You're beginning to realize it's more of a problem than we ever thought.
It's a systemic problem.
Yeah, yes. It is a systemic problem. One of the things that sort of for those of us who've been around for a while have experienced and didn't realize is that the ability of law enforcement to actually come up with evidence that is really certain has been a real problem up until the 1980s. None of the tools that were available were scientific. Fingerprinting, we always thought, was the thing that would just mark somebody, and then we found out fingerprinting is not that reliable. It's prone to a lot of mistakes. And then the other things, such as eyewitness testimony, which everyone thought, oh my God, you got an eyewitness, this happened. And now we find out that eyewitness testimony is one of the most unreliable pieces of evidence upon which to convict someone. I mean, we had a case where numerous cases, but one, for example, where somebody is up two floors or multiple floors of a building a block or two away who identifies somebody, and that becomes a good basis for the conviction. When DNA came about, it changed the whole game because it was a scientific basis upon which you could actually take evidence, assuming it was available, and it is in lots of criminal cases, and be able to pinpoint, did this evidence come from this individual or did it not? The reason that becomes so important, why I want to say something, is because it changed the whole nature of the way we looked at the criminal justice system. When this happened, it showed that the system itself was actually broken in terms of its reliability for getting convictions. Not that you can't do that, not that people aren't guilty, but that too many people were then subject to the possibility that they weren't guilty, that they didn't commit the crimes for which they were convicted.
Was that about the time you started the Innocence Project?
It came out of that time. The Innocence Project work started in 1992 with Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld in New York City. It was their work that was with people who were on death row all around the country. Within 5-6 years, they were able to actually exonerate 60 to 70 people who were on death row all around the country, who when they presented in 1998 at Northwestern University in Chicago, each of those individuals walked across the law school stage saying, if it weren't for the Innocence Project, the state of Florida would have killed me 2 years ago, or the state of Texas would have executed me 4 years ago, or last year. Men, women, people of color, it was continuing. That was the beginning of the awakening across the country. That's when the Innocence Movement got started out of that, and how we got started in 2001, because three of us went from the university here up to that conference, and it was like we came back and we've got to do something. If we can, we've got to do something. As Stephanie was alluding to earlier, Illinois not only has been leading in exonerations and wrongful conviction cases, but there had been some notorious cases in Illinois during the 1990s that, in fact, were innocence cases. That's how Northwestern actually got started with their Center on Wrongful Convictions during that time. It became very clear that in Illinois, there was a problem. We didn't have to go out and search for it. We could say, hey, look, this is what's happening. We know that already. We need to do something.
How many exonerations has the Illinois Innocence Project had now in 25 years?
In the past 25 years, we have had 33 clients brought to freedom in exoneration. 21 of those have been in just the past 5 years. We are working on a lot of cases. Oftentimes these cases take over a decade to work on. We continue, and we've been expanding our project. We continue and expand our representation of clients. 33 to date.
Of those 33, they're not all people who have been exonerated in a technical legal sense. They're people we've helped get out of prison who are presently continuing to work on their cases. But the great bulk of the people we've been able to get out, we've actually been able to get exonerated.
One of the things that's unique about the Illinois Innocence Project is its use of undergraduate students. When did that start?
We were at that time, the Downstate Illinois Innocence Project started out of a class in the Legal Studies Department at UIS. And that's why we will be forever tied to UIS. I mean, we're located here. It was the beginning of the recognition that you could actually use undergraduate students to help in various ways, but at that time, in helping attorneys investigate cases, to look at evidence, to examine documents, to see where there might be things that needed to be pursued. Because at that time, we were not doing death penalty cases. Governor Ryan actually put a moratorium on in January 2003 anyways. We were looking at non-death penalty cases, and we were looking at non-DNA cases because, again, we didn't have any lawyers. We had students, and we had a really good investigator who was able to lead and who had experience working in innocence cases. We were able to work with two or three lawyers on specific cases where they had great need for help and couldn't afford to do that. Our students would be looking through the documents and working with the lawyers, and that's how we got started. It was really in 2001, and then the base of our work ever since then has been always having a class of students and then interns working with the project, and we are the only undergraduate-based Innocence Project in the country, which has been one of the major distinctions that we've had from all of the others.
Most of the others are graduate law schools.
Where they use interns, most of the others are law school based, out of law school clinics. Northwestern was a good example. That was out of their law school. That's where they were based. And then the only other one in Illinois is the Exoneration Project. They use some of the students from the law school out of the University of Chicago. The models are different throughout the country. Each of the projects is different. Each of them is financially on their own, which has been part of our struggle through the years, as has NPR. We weren't even part of a national network that was giving us any funding. We had to survive totally on what we could get. And the big change came in 2011 when we received the first of what turned out to be numerous grants from the federal government to do work on cases that involve DNA testing. And that's when, over the next year, it became apparent that we had to shift from being the Downstate Illinois Innocence Project to the Illinois Innocence Project, because we quickly took on, I don't remember, maybe as many as a dozen cases had under the grant, and most of those were out of Chicago. and it didn't make sense to keep ourselves downstate, even though we had aligned with Southern Illinois University Law School in Carbondale. To have their students working on cases in Chicago would have been a little bit challenging.
Great evolution. And since then, you actually have implemented a lot of things to try to help prevent false conviction. You're doing police training. What else has evolved from all this to help reduce the amount of false convictions?
One of the biggest accomplishments, I think, of our project, and another distinctive base of our project, is our police training. And what happened was that there was a supervisor of one of the police training units in Champaign who came over and took our wrongful conviction class, which we continue to teach to this day and recruit students to work with us. And he became so moved by what he heard that he decided he wanted to help bring this into the training of recruits. And I won't go into all the details about that, but what's happened is that a few years ago, the Police Standards Board in Illinois added a wrongful conviction training unit to its required curriculum. And so we have been, since then, training each recruit in every, there are like, what, seven or eight?
Eight
training facilities in Illinois. And every law enforcement recruit has to go through one of those trainings in order to go out in the field. We've developed a model that is extraordinary in terms of being able to introduce these mostly young people to the fact that when they go out on the street, there is this possibility of wrongful conviction. This is why it exists. This is who gets impacted by it. We have exonerees that come in and talk to them at each of those training units. And it's been recognized now as the sole model throughout the country that's doing this kind of work, and we're getting requests for help from all of them. We've trained over 6,000 students since we began, and we're expanding the program as much as we can, but very carefully, with a very careful model of being able to work with those young people.
Well, that's impressive. I would assume you're getting some grants or something to help make it sustainable to do that.
We have longtime supporters that have helped fund the project. We also have federal grants that Larry talked about, and then the state has given us an appropriation. All of those together help us as we expand this work. We have been now certified to go into the mobile team units. As we went in 2023, when this was mandated, we went from 3 trainings a year to 35 trainings in 1 year. And we have a longtime law enforcement officer who's retired, who's our director. He goes in and leads the team, an innocence attorney, and 2 exonerees. And we are talking, as we go in there, we are giving a whole case study of the 5 main contributors of wrongful convictions and best police practices for them as they're doing their work to help avoid those. One of the things the directors were saying is, we need this not only in the training sites for the cadets, but we need longtime law enforcement. We've been down to Texas a number of times over the past few years to train longtime law enforcement. They are asking us to help them replicate this in Texas. Same thing in Michigan. We've had Innocence Organization from Toronto, Canada come in to watch us and help replicate there, and also Florida. But we're the only ones doing this nationwide. It's groundbreaking.
An innovative program.
Yeah, yes. Some people may ask, well, why are you doing that? You're an innocence project. We had from the very beginning a broad set of missions. And the primary one, of course, we started with was advocacy. And that's the one that ultimately sustains the entire project as an innocence project. And the second is education, which we've talked about with the undergraduates, and that's linked to the third, which is reform. What we're trying to do is to not just get people out of prison, but to figure out ways of changing the policies and practices that result in people going into prison. If we could put ourselves out of business in 10 years, that would be great. I mean, that's not going to happen, unfortunately. We're not only doing that, but we're also doing a whole variety of reforms, and asked Stephanie to talk a little bit about what we're doing currently, but she mentioned something earlier that I think is really important. It had to do with juveniles being susceptible to confession being a big problem in the past. One of the things that our project was able to do is working with the legislature to get into policy the fact that police, law enforcement cannot lie to juveniles in order to get them to confess to a crime they didn't commit. I mean, that's not quite the way it's framed, but that's what was happening, that they were going in and deceiving. And so that was one of a series of things that we've been able to do with the legislature, and Stephanie can update you on where we are now.
The other thing I heard about was when somebody does get exonerated, they're not always compensated for the time they've been wrongfully imprisoned?
Yes. So they have to go back after the state has decided to drop the charges and release them due to coming to recognize that all the evidence points elsewhere. They aren't immediately then exonerated. They then have to go through a whole other hearing in the convicting court, oftentimes with the same prosecutor that convicted them, and do what's called a certificate of innocence hearing. And it's a full evidentiary hearing where they have to prove their innocence of the crime that they were wrongfully convicted of. And it's only then that if they get that certificate of innocence that they can get compensated. Right now, Illinois is one of the lowest in the entire country. We cap compensation. It's $293,000 no matter how long you've spent in prison. So we have a client that's been exonerated, received his certificate of innocence, Brian Beals. He spent 35 years wrongfully imprisoned. So right now he would get about $6,000 or $7,000 per year of being wrongfully imprisoned. It costs over $50,000 to keep somebody in prison. So we are working on getting a law passed to amend the certificate of innocence recovery to at least up to the federally recommended minimum standards of $50,000 per year.
Because you lose every year potential earnings when you're in prison.
Exactly. They've been taken from their community. All those years, they haven't been able to work or put away for retirement. You've got states. Texas pays $80,000 per year of wrongful imprisonment. Georgia just passed a law paying $75,000 per year. Oklahoma, $50,000, and an additional $50,000 if they spent time on death row. Arizona just passed a law. They pay 200% the median income for each of the years the person was wrongfully imprisoned.
Does that act as a deterrent or something to make prosecutions more careful to make sure they get it right, or is it doesn't really impact them?
You hope so, but what it really is trying to do is at least give some modicum of restitution for what we've done as a state, wrongfully imprisoned somebody for a crime they didn't commit. And don't forget that when you do that, you've left the real perpetrator out on the street to continue doing other crimes and harming other people. And so it's very important. I think the education and the training and opening the eyes and working collaboratively with law enforcement, with prosecutors, and judges is going to help prevent wrongful convictions if we are understanding the importance of evidence-based investigation, not just, oh, I have a hunch, it's this person, and then trying to get and having tunnel vision and trying to make all the evidence focus on one person because you have a gut that that's the person who did this.
It's amazing work for 25 years. How are you going to recognize the anniversary this year?
We're going to be doing a number of things throughout the year. One of them, I know we're going to be doing some other community voices with clients and some of our attorneys, also with our people that are doing the police training. November 7th is our big gala, our 25th anniversary gala. It's going to be at the Crown Plaza. All year throughout, you'll be seeing different things and news articles and just interviews that we're doing and as we celebrate this throughout the year.
Anything you'd like to leave us with?
When we started this effort in 2001, I don't think I could have envisioned the evolution of the work that we've done to be as extraordinarily successful as we are. There were years that I was literally going to people begging because I didn't think we would be able to survive another year. And now our project is clearly recognized as one of the top innocence organizations in the entire world, because the Innocence Network, of which we are a part, actually goes beyond the United States and includes countries all over the world that are trying to do innocence work. And we are part of that. I never would have envisioned that we could reach this level of success. And so it's been extraordinary, and the leadership that's been brought to it now by people like Stephanie and our past executive director and attorney, John Hanlon, and Lauren Caseberg, and now all of the staff that we have. It's just an extraordinary achievement. And this is at UIS in Springfield, and people need to understand it's one of the jewels, not just of the university, but of this community.
Thank you for co-founding it and helping guide it for all these years and still being involved with it. And Stephanie, you continue to make it advance into the future. One of the things people may not recognize is if somebody feels they need these services or have a family member, that's probably more who reaches out to you, I'm guessing. How does that process work? And you probably get a slew of people saying, I'm innocent. How do you sort through that?
Yes. Yeah, so we oftentimes do hear from family members, oftentimes from people directly from prison. We get over 200 applications every year written to us. And when people write to us, we will send them an application to fill out, and then it will go through that process of us doing case evaluations and determining if we're able to take a case. We have so many people applying, and we give, it's the first time their case has really been looked at. They've been writing from prison for over a decade, two decades, and finally somebody will at least look at their case and see if there is a pathway to exoneration.
How would someone contact the Innocence Project if they wanted to?
They would write to the Illinois Innocence Project here at UIS, or they can email us. They can Google it and find us. It's Illinois Innocence Project, not just Innocence Project, because you'll get the New York project, but Illinois Innocence Project, and can request an application.
Thank you very much for joining us on Community Voices. We look forward to talking with more of the folks involved with the Illinois Innocence Project over this year to celebrate the 25th. Again, thank you both for what you do.
Thank you so much, Randy, for having us.
Thanks, Randy.
What does the Community Voices process look like? Well, it starts with trying to identify a good neighbor to talk to or an event that may be interesting that for some folks it may be hard to get to. First, we get that on the radar, figure out when that is going to happen if there is a date involved with it. But more than anything, we depend on you to suggest a guest. By emailing communityvoices@mprillinois.org, we then go into a process of getting in contact with that person, figuring out if there's enough there, which there usually is, to talk about to help us get to know a little bit more about them or what they're working on or an event that's coming up. We have them come into the studios here at MPR Illinois and do an interview. That interview then gets edited and scheduled to air. It eventually comes on the air and then also gets posted at mprillinois.org, where we share it on social media and encourage our guests and you to do so too. If you've missed a past Community Voices, go to mprillinois.org right now, and thanks for being part of Community Voices.